Welcome, people, to a new episode of The Watchdog with Loki on Mint Press. Since we are going against the grain and dealing with issues that are largely neglected by the corporate media, it's really essential that we have your support in this mission. So please like, subscribe, and contribute to the Patreon account. We are now sitting on the time where we have seen the decline of empire happening before our eyes. 20 years of occupation, a war longer than World War I and World War II put together, around 250,000 people killed, and a bonanza of profit for military contractors. The Afghan war has ended in humiliation for the United States and NATO allies. And today, to discuss that, we are joined by the myth, the legend, Joe Glinton. How are you, Joe?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on. It's good to see you. It's good to see your face.
It's good to see you too. It's great to be joined by you, man. And I think that the majority of people that have heard of Joe Glinton will have heard of you through your refusal to continue serving in what you viewed to be an unjust war in Afghanistan, and that resulting in your imprisonment. What's the story?
I suppose my story is very classic. I'll probably share it with a lot of the guys I went to Afghanistan with. Working class guy, from a very poor background, and the army is way out. And that's pretty much why I got there. I tend to think of it as a spectrum. There's the economic end in terms of drivers of recruitment, the economic end, I suppose, guys like me, and then there's the ideological end. And I was definitely towards the economic end. I think in this country, we have some quite highfalutin, and when you reflect on them deeply, quite shaky ideas about what the military is and what it does. We tend to view the military through the prism of the Second World War, the supposed good war, the fight against fascism. Now, I know and you know that the armies of today are nothing like that, but there's a touch of that, and it colours our view. So for everyone, I think, even if you're from the economic end of the spectrum for recruitment like me, there's going to be a touch of ideology, because the way we think about the military has been shaped by the state, shaped by politicians. And so a little bit of that, but mostly I was broke from working class community. The army advertises itself as a kind of engine for social mobility, and a way out. And if you're a young, listless, working class person, that's very compelling, and it's kind of the if you're a working class person, it's very you kind of exist in close proximity to that as an option, as a way out of poverty, and so that was very much my motivation.
Also, what's interesting in your book Soldier Box, which I recommend to everyone, Why I Won't Return to War, you wrote it while on remand, as far as I understand. Now, there's three little periods where it seems you're drifting towards joining the army. You know, it seems that the relationship did start in the school period when you were part of the cadets, but each time you'd think about joining it, there'd be a reason not to, or just to hold back for a little bit longer. But the final pivotal point seemed to be September 11th.
Definitely. That was definitely a big factor. And I remember, I must have been 18 or 19. I had a Saturday job to try and make some cash with a carpet fitter, very unglamorous. And I was fitting a carpet in a house in Norwich where I was living at the time, when the news of the two towers came over the radio. And I was with a man who'd served in the Falklands in the British Army. And he said, the world has changed. And of course, he was right in many ways. But I suppose that moment and the kind of the impression of a collision of forces and somehow a call to arms, and the echoes of the way it was framed was almost an echo of the fight against fascism in the 40s. And we know better, obviously, but those are very powerful ideological forces. And that was definitely a factor, the idea of, I mean, in a way, if you take them out of context, though, the ideas are not wrong, that you would want to go and defend something, that you would, it was advertised as helping women, as going there to help Afghans. And they're not ignoble. But they are wrong. That isn't the business that the British military is in. But that kind of cocktail of ideological things and the background and the economic compulsion as well kind of coagulated and made me reconsider. I considered it several times growing up, as you say, that made me reconsider. And so it led me to join when I was 22. So a few years after that, it kind of cooked in my brain for a while. And I joined up when I was 22.
Joe, that's a beautiful word that you have just used. Can you, what was it? Coagulated?
Coagulated.
Fantastic. I love it. And just a question on that point, because in your book, you mention that there was a kind of unspoken, maybe tension between the fact that your mum had attended the march against the Iraq War. You know, this was the largest simultaneous mobilization of human beings in recorded human history that we know of, around 2 to 3 million people at least across the world marching the streets against, well, I mean, there are those that say 2 million alone in London, but across the world, millions of people hitting the streets against the Iraq War. What was that like to have maybe a more critical position? And you do mention also that you had some type of idea of the political elite, but you were, as you put it, in line with a sort of politically uninterested prototype that was you know, definitely perfectly in position to do this at the time. So what was that tension potentially like between you and your mother's point of view about
it was a strange thing for her, I think, because she was obviously against the war, and correctly so. But I suppose it's also that thing where she saw me, I wasn't really going anywhere. I was listless, as I said. I was going around dead-end jobs, factory work, a bit of kind of working, being a waiter, being a kitchen boy and stuff like that. So it's probably, from her perspective, it was probably difficult for her. She made it very clear that she didn't agree with the war, and she suspected I would go to the war if I joined at that time. But at the same time, I guess it's that a mother's thing where she kind of sees that her son is not really going anywhere. And at least it's something. Maybe I don't know. I can't speak to her process. Maybe he'll go. Maybe he won't. I mean, I'm sure it was shared by a lot of mothers at the time, as it is before every war and during every war when they see it. And their daughters, of course, who can join the British and American militaries, etc., and go off. So yeah, there is a tension there. But there was a tension there. But she kind of she knew that was what I was going to do. She knew she wouldn't talk me out of it. I was very determined and brash, and as everyone is at 21. And decided I wanted to go and do that. In the end, she was proven correct, of course. But that was the kind of circumstances at the time. And there's something in there, I think. I mean, my generation, I suppose I'm an older version of a millennial. I'm 40 next year, so I'm 82. And I suppose I'm a child of Thatcher. And Thatcher, as we know, the communities, I suppose, which I actually came from and I came from, were smashed. The working class, kind of the unions and the culture, were removed, and you kind of end up in this void. When I look back at it, this kind of neoliberal void where there's no politics and no future, and the politics which maybe previous generations would have had was stripped away. So I was completely apolitical, and didn't really have any real critical understanding of the world around me, except what you pluck from the air. And I suppose that's also caught up with ideas. The army's deep, profoundly caught up with ideas about masculinity, about proving yourself, about being of service somehow. And what that really means is kind of handing off your agency, and that is somehow noble, that you subsume yourself within a cause which is available. And I think now I can reflect critically, that was definitely what was happening. A mix of the economic, the ideological, but also the context. That was a part from a deep politicized class which had been smashed by neoliberalism and Thatcherism.
And, you know, obviously this is the fourth war that Britain has fought in Afghanistan across the last two centuries, the first being in 1849, while Britain was simultaneously forcing millions of people across the border in China into an addiction to heroin. You know, this was the way that Britain became the world's number one economy. It was the way Britain industrialized by this expansion across the world. It ended in humiliation, the 1839, not 49, it ended in humiliation, despite having 10,000 troops paying £600 a year to the chiefs to guarantee the British route from India into Afghanistan. Then obviously you had the shooting of Afghans from cannons, as was later done in India. Also, But again, it resulted in a humiliating defeat. You also had the British using bombs the first time they were used in Afghanistan, bombed from the sky in 1919 on one day, one single day, using over 300 bombs in one day. Was there any consciousness, whether explicit or implicit, within the army when you entered it about this history in Afghanistan? Was it taught as part of the training? Was it dealt with in any way?
The military is extremely proud of its colonial past, and in a particular way, in a particularly reactionary way. So, for example, my unit, the Royal Logistics Corps, one of our forebear units, won a Victoria Cross at Rorke's Drift, immortalised in the film Zulu. And so our troop was named Dalton Troop after this guy, Commissar Dalton. And even when I got to my unit, I can remember before we were getting ready to go to Afghanistan, people would take Kipling quotes from the poem Kim. When the Afghans come out to, you know, cut you up, pick up your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier. But these are like tiny little kind of fragments of that past, plucked out and taken out of context. So in a way, we were vaguely familiar with it. It was like a small component. And I remember people taking those poems and they'd put it on the wall of the training wing where we did our preparation training, but completely out of context and kind of glorified. And I suppose it's important to understand that in the British military, for example, we have every regiment has the regimental colours. It's a big flag and it'll be covered in the names of places. And some of those will be the Somme or, you know, First World War battles. Others, which are more obscure or were more obscure to me then, would be the residency in Kabul or just Kabul or Delhi or the names of obscure places in what's now India and Pakistan. And of course, this history is a kind of central part of our identity, but it's not really understood, I don't think, and it's definitely glorified. And what's kind of brushed over or even glorified itself is the fact that it involves massive colonial violence, the pillaging of cities during the Indian Mutiny. Just huge, huge militarized violence always against people of color, whether it's Africans, whether it's Indians, whether it's Pakistanis or Afghans. So it's kind of there, but it's not really contextualized, if you understand what I mean.
I mean, and also the important thing to emphasize is that even at this point in the late 1800s, in Bethnal Green, if you were a manual laborer, your life expectancy was 16 years old. You know, we're not talking about a situation where people within the motherland were living high off of the benefits of British colonial spoils. You know, there was an extent to which later on in the Attlee period, there were mechanisms that were created to make the disparity between the rich and the poor a bit smaller. But the reality is that it wasn't something that the vast majority of people were enjoying the spoils of. Another question that I had for you is at that point then where you enter the army, can you describe to me the stratification within it and the balance of power really within the army as you saw it?
Sure. Yeah, it's a world which it's stratified in a way which is alien, but it's also not. And I've tried to come to ways to explain it because of the kind of rituals and the badges of rank, it can seem quite arcane. But you can imagine it as the your average soldier who joins, who's a working class person, joins. They are the workforce, and then above them you'll have people who've served 10 or 15 years, and they will be the senior management, the sergeants, the staff sergeants, the colour sergeants, the sergeant majors. And they're the kind of the petty bourgeoisie, if you like, the middle management. And then you'll have people who are normally university graduates, some of whom are from very privileged backgrounds, in particular regiments, the very posh regiments like the Guards with the big busbies, the big bearskin hats you'll see in London. And they are the kind of figureheads, I suppose. The army, the military is run by that middle strata, really. But the officers kind of, They sign everything off, but then beneath them is a workforce. It's basically a workforce in all its diversity, But then obviously what's different is that it's a highly disciplined and regimented and hierarchical organization, much more than your average job, I suspect. That may be changing. We've seen how military patterns of functioning have crept into work, and they are fetishized and celebrated. And there's an impression, I think, in business that it should be more like the military and people should have less agency. But it is fundamentally different. So that it's, you can really understand it as a class system, as a very rigid class system. Because and I understand people often ask me, like, what is an officer? Why does this person salute that person when that person's been in much longer than this person? And it's basically the people in charge are normally graduates and normally better off. And then there's the middle management, the sergeant, for example. And then there's the rest of us. There's me, the kind of corporal, lance corporal, the private soldier. And we're the kind of workhorses, if you like.
And when you were in Afghanistan, in Kandahar, I remember?
Kandahar, yeah, 2006.
In 2002. And Six. What exactly, 2006, sorry, my bad. And what exactly were you doing there, and for how long were you there from 2006 onwards?
So we went, Afghanistan had been very quiet since 2001. It had been a kind of light footprint. Iraq had taken over because it was much more obviously controversial. And all the focus of the media had been on Iraq. I suppose the rationale, I mean, there are competing rationales. Basically, we were given Basra in the south of Iraq, and we failed massively in American eyes. And so the British, in order to maintain that proximity to American power, were desperate, and they oversold their credentials, their supposedly amazing credentials at counterinsurgency, and said, give us another chance. And we got Helmand province. And Kandahar is the adjacent province. So the main base was in Kandahar. So we went in 2006 under that aegis I was with 16 Air Assault Brigade, 3rd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment was the main infantry unit. And I was in the logistics unit. So our job was to supply and sustain that operation. My job, when you bring it down to the lowest level, was the ammunition. So me and about five or six guys had all the ammunition for the whole theater and the whole operation. And that was our job, to supply wherever it was, different kinds of missiles, artillery shells, down to pistol bullets. We held all that. And so we went out March 2006. It looked like the operation was kind of on and off for a while. Would we go, wouldn't we? But we did go. We were some of the first people there. It's the first time I'd ever been on a plane, was when I flew to Kabul. And it's strange to see the scenes in Kabul, because that place has such powerful memories attached to it. And it's such a spectacular landing with the mountains which hem in the runway. And so we arrived and we were set straight to work. Shortly afterwards, the infantry turned up, the fighting soldiers, the teeth arms, as we called them, who did the killing. And almost immediately, the various justifications we'd been given, they were very nebulous, to help Afghan girls go to school, to stop the opium trade, to build infrastructure, fell away. And it very quickly became clear that our presence had become a lightning rod, where there hadn't been an insurgency in the sense that there was later. There suddenly was one. And everyone who didn't want us there, and we clearly weren't welcome, was very quickly in the media folded under the banner Taliban or anti-coalition militia. And so what was framed as a peacekeeping operation, in effect, among other things, very quickly became a shooting war. To the point where we, on this peacekeeping mission, we ran out of high artillery ammunition, and we were in charge of it. We saw this high artillery ammunition just go out. We were loading it onto planes faster than they could fly it into the theater. And so that was the first maybe 3 months of the tour, which really, for me, brought into relief it raised questions about the narratives we've been given about why we were there.
And then explain to us how you moved from that point to refusing to continue your service.
Yeah, I think it kind of built up over the course of that tour. There was no kind of light bulb moment particularly, but we knew what was going on in theatre. We knew our presence had created an insurgency, had created a war. We knew that we were using a lot of air power, that we were bombing things, we were bombing, calling in airstrikes, etc. And I knew, it was very clear to me from the briefings we would get every day, that I was part of a chain of destruction and pain for Afghan people, the very people you understand that we'd been told we were there to protect and help. And so that led to a kind of internal conflict, I suppose. But when you're on operations, you have very little time. You're very busy. You've been trained and indoctrinated to be part of the team. So you just crack on. That's the term you use. You just crack on. And I did. I did put questions aside because that we say that's above your pay grade. It's above your pay grade to think that much, and just push through it. And acquitted myself fairly well. We were there for 7 months, all through the summer, incredibly hot summer, just moving ammunition around. And the deaths started to mount up on both sides over the course. And it was really when I came back that it started to crystallize, because then I had the time to think about it and try and start to understand some of the context and history. I wouldn't really start to understand that fully until much later. So what crystallized was very much a kind of moral objection. It wasn't really political at the time. It was an instinctive kind of reflex that this is not what we were told we were going to be doing. I think we're being lied to, this kind of creeping sense of being deceived. And so, yeah, after I came back, and it's a strange thing because I was a very committed soldier. I planned to stay for 22 years. And I was promoted from that tour, which they must have regretted afterwards. I was promoted. I was given these glowing reports. Glenton is an intellectual soldier. He leads his fellow soldiers. All this stuff from my my major, two majors who are in charge of me. And then afterwards is when I really it started to, the sense of deception that I'd been deceived started to formulate more solidly in my head.
And then what was the next step?
So at that time, we were covered by something called Harmony Guidelines. And Harmony Guidelines being that you can't deploy twice in 18 months. And I had this kind of moral objection, and I had planned to just see out my, within that 18 months, I could have seen out my time, signed off and left, basically. And that's what I planned to do. And it probably would have never become anything more political than it was. And probably the Army must regret that they pulled the rug and tried to redeploy me. At the same time, I'd started to develop post-traumatic stress from some incidents on operations. We were regularly mortared. They were the locals. Everyone's under the heading Taliban. So we'll go that Taliban, if you like. We're firing rockets into camps. Some Americans were hit relatively close to me. And so the combination of those things, I suppose, that they interplayed in a very interesting way. I was told I would redeploy. And at that moment, I was forced to clarify immediately in my mind. And I said, no, I'm not, which is frowned upon in the military, as you can imagine, rigidly hierarchical organization. And I said, no, I'm not. And they said, yes, you are. And we kind of played this ping pong game. At the same time, my PTSD, which was diagnosed many years later, was ignored. As is often the case, veterans will tell you that mental health stuff was always ignored or diagnosed down at the time. They insisted I would go. And in the end, I suppose it's a grand tradition. I voted with my feet and I went AWOL, absent without leave, went on the run. And I ended up, I had my blood money from tour. You come back for a working class guy, relatively rich. I think I had about £8,000 because you don't pay tax on tour and there's no way to spend your money. So I went on the run. Eventually ended up in Australia. I was on the run for 18 months. When I got back, I was top of the list, almost like an Osama bin Laden figure. They had a list of everybody who was AWOL. That was many people, and I was top of the list. A very proud moment for me. And I was away for 18 months. During that time, I started to read more history, and I started to read more politics, and I started to try and put it in context. And when I came back, my anti-war views, anti-imperialist views, I suppose, were much more solid. There was more of a kind of intellectual element to them. Handed myself in, was immediately charged with AWOL. That was later up to desertion. And I was put in for a court-martial, charged and put in for a court-martial, which is the military version of a criminal trial, I suppose.
And at what point did you connect with Stop the War Coalition?
So not long after I got back. And I suppose it's an interesting link because my mum, of course, had been at the Stop the War marches. And wise head that she is, she suggested that I should reach out to those people, get in touch with those people. We did. Lindsay German, Chris Nynam, people who you know yourself. I started to speak, still serving in the military, started to speak on platforms, started to speak to the media. Charges for that, because speaking to the media is illegal if you're in the military, were added various charges were added for going on the radio, talking to Sky News, talking to the BBC, or whatever. So these charges started to mount up, and the case, I suppose, started to build momentum. But I came back. I came back determined that I would, even if I went down, I would. People would know. People would know what it was about, and I would try and inform people. Try and inform people, because over the 18 months, of course, the war in Afghanistan had disintegrated even more. Many more people had died. And I watched it from Australia. Australia obviously also had troops there, so it was regularly on the news and kept up with it. And the war had just snowballed. That first tour had set the pattern. And I think all the pretense of peacekeeping had by that time slipped away. And it was just a war between various groups between which civilians were caught up and dying in large numbers.
And then you were sentenced. How long were you sentenced to?
So there's I did a month on remand for speaking to the media, and then they let me out. And in the end, it's an important detail, I think. They charged me with desertion and all these charges for speaking to the media. And my me and my barrister and my lawyer got together and said, we will use this court martial to indict the British military and the British government for their role for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we took both of those on, both those conflicts on. We prepared this gigantic defence document. We sent it to the Armed Forces Prosecution Services, which is like the Crown Prosecution, but the military version of it. And they went quiet. And 2 weeks later, we rang them up and said, well, what do you think of that? And they said, OK, we're going to drop all the charges speaking to the media. We're going to drop the charge for desertion down to the AWOL. And I never denied being AWOL. I mean, clearly I wasn't there. But I obviously I had reasons for being AWOL. And so in the end, we pled guilty to the AWOL. There was never really a court martial. And a court martial, so you understand, it isn't a jury of your peers. It's a panel of senior officers it's their job to kind of crush you because they're all concerned about discipline and the reputation of the army, etc. But they capitulated completely. So I was just sentenced. It was just a sentence in the end, because there was a guilty plea for AWOL. I was given 9 months with remission. I did 5 in the military prison in Colchester, the infamous glass house, they call it. And I served out my time there with a bunch of other soldiers, many with similar views, many who had come back with post-traumatic stress, many who collided with the army, been betrayed by the army, and were deeply embittered and angered. And many of whom are to this day very good friends of mine. So yeah, it was a very interesting period.
General Dannett, who now sits in the House of Lords, early on said, we probably wound up and maybe still are killing a lot of farmers. And for all the toothlessness of it, the ICC did find that there is, quote unquote, a reasonable basis to believe that British troops committed war crimes in Afghanistan. What were some of the crimes of the British?
Various. And I suppose for context, the problem isn't now with the Overseas Operations Bill. We may never get the full picture. The things that we do know about, for example, our Marine A, who's a Marine who executed a wounded prisoner said to be Taliban, we never know because the body was never found, as I understand it, executed him on camera, the body cams, the helmet cams that they started wearing by, I think that was 2011, while quoting Shakespeare, shuffle off this mortal coil, you C-word. That's one very prominent example. There have been allegations of special forces routinely, the SAS and SBS over a period of time, executing people in their homes. And various other examples of not elite troops, but just other troops shooting innocent people and various other atrocities. The question, I suppose, is one of justice and accountability. And I fear that the passing of the Overseas Operations Bill with a massive Tory majority that we have, it was always going to pass, I think, will prevent that. And that's just Afghanistan. Obviously, there are other examples in Iraq along similar lines. And folded into that, I suppose, there was also lots of cases from Northern Ireland, which are also included in that kind of constellation of allegations. So it's hard to know, but I have no doubt that war crimes were committed. I think even in the noblest war we could imagine, which Afghanistan and Iraq are not, it's the nature of the beast that people will go wild, they'll go feral, and they will murder people. It's what comes with it, which is why we have to avoid. It should always be a last resort. Military violence should always be a last resort, at best. But certainly atrocities were caused. The concern is that no one will ever be held accountable for them now.
Now, we understand that you were based in Kandahar, but the Helmand province, it was home to 10,000 British soldiers on almost 140 different bases. And it's also the centre of opium production in Afghanistan. We know that in the year before the invasion, one of the things that the Taliban did to seek international embrace and acceptance was to cut the opium production to almost zero. Today, as it stands, Afghanistan makes up over 90% of the source of the world's opium. We also know that a British diplomat who also worked for BAE Systems, Sherard Lewis Cooper Coles, was talking about the Afghan National Police. And he said that 60% of them that came through Helmand to be trained by the British tested positive for the consumption of opiates. What was this? How did this look like from the other side of it? And what exactly do you think happened?
It's the ANP, the Afghan National Police. Even when I went back to Afghanistan here, and it was still an issue. It was widely accepted. It was common knowledge that lots of them didn't really want to be there and weren't highly trained or motivated. And there was lots of drug abuse and various other. Also, there was extortion of local people. They would throw up roadblocks and various other things. And definitely, large parts of that force were using drugs. I mean, the opium question is a big one because it was actually a major part of the rationale, or one of the various. I mean, I don't even want to call it a rationale, to be honest, because it was so confused. But opium was one of the things which was used to justify, and they talked about Afghan opium on the streets of Glasgow. That was one of the kind of rhetorical points they made. I know there was lots of effort to burn opium. But I also know that 2006 was a bumper year. It was one of the biggest crops for many, many years. And that was the year that some of this, that we went in. It's a strange one because I also feel the opium argument kind of fell by the wayside. But I do know that when we went in there, because opium at the lower level, because opium is a growth crop. It grows well in Helmand. It's brilliantly, adapted to that climate. And there was an issue that when we went in there and started saying we're going to burn it, we're going to trample it, we're going to get rid of it, that was a bad idea because that stepped on lots of people's toes. And we're not just talking about, of course, there are the big opium producers, the people who are making lots of money about it, but also for your average farmer in Helmand Province, and that's his livelihood. And it's just one example of many, I think, of a complete lack of understanding of the context of Helmand, of how it worked, of how it functioned as a province, that because opium, of course, was central to the local economy. And there's many examples of just huge misunderstanding and ignorance and arrogance and thinking we could go in and do whatever we wanted without really attempting to understand the context.
Well, of course, also Alfred McCoy looks at the way when the CIA were backing both local and foreign fighters to come into Afghanistan and fight the Russians, they contributed massively to a situation where the fighters were generating funds through the production of opium. And then that led to the amount of heroin addicts in Pakistan going from literally zero to a million within the space of about a decade and a half. So it would have been something to predict. You know, what would explain the massive increase in these kind of drugs on the streets in Britain following the invasion of Afghanistan, do you think there's a relationship?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean the obvious thing that leaps out at me, of course, is the example of South America, of cocaine coming into particular communities in America. I don't know. I don't feel confident to say enough about that, but I do know that was a thing. I do know it essentially involved the CIA. Mm. I do know that opiates are used as a kind of social suppressant in the past, or crack cocaine, as it was in LA and places like that in the 80s, I want to say. I don't know beyond that. There are, you know, people talk, soldiers talk, and they talk about a guy I know who was in a particularly elite unit before the war properly kicked off in 2006, was out there, and his job was to train Afghan police to go out, grab opium, and the opium would all be brought to a compound once it was snatched, and then some trucks would drive in and take it away. And he, you know, that he's not what I would say, he's not a conspiracist, but he was like, I don't know where that went. I don't know where that went. Someone came and took it away, and it was not, it was above my pay grade, that old thing again, to ask. I mean, it's just impossible to say, to be honest. But you hear stories from other soldiers about their interactions with the raids on opium production factories, and so on. It's just impossible to pin down. It's so opaque.
Yeah. I think often what people are overlooking is that the government that was being propped up, you know, we know historically when Hamid Karzai, the former president, his brother, was well known to be a drug lord, really, who made a hell of a lot of money off of the production of opium. But we also know that in the last elections, only about 2 million people turned out to vote out of a population of 36 million people. In fact, David Miliband, when he was there in his capacity as foreign minister for Britain, he asked two Afghan ministers how long they thought the capital of Helmand would hold up without their presence, without the presence of the NATO forces. And he was told about 24 hours. Was this collapse foreseeable?
Yes, I think it was. I think if you have had an eye on Afghanistan and you've read beyond the headlines, and the headlines are generally, we'll probably get to that, but the media is a massive failure in coverage. But if you've read beyond the headlines, then the recent collapse, what we've seen, was a long time coming, and the creakiness of the Afghan government was very apparent. When I was there last year, looking for the zero units who've reappeared in the last few days, saying they'll never surrender. These CIA, they're made up of Afghans, but they're CIA run militias. It was very clear that the Afghan government's grip on power was not great. And this has probably been the case at least for a couple of years. I mean, there's articles from 2016 talking about a similar problem as in Iraq, which became apparent with the when ISIS came storming down, that ghost soldiers, ghost battalions, soldiers on paper only, our whole armies on paper only. And it's still on the British Army website. I checked a couple of days ago. They say we trained 350,000 Afghan National Army soldiers. There are figures from 2016 which suggest that between 100,000 and 200,000 of those did not exist, and that their wages were being funneled to corrupt generals and corrupt officials. And so, you know, someone was on the take, and those guys were probably at home on a small stipend or whatever, or just never existed, had deserted, had gone home, and who can blame them? And so I think if you've, as I say, for people who've read beyond the headlines, it's not that much of a surprise. Perhaps the sheer speed was shocking, but the fact that it was going to happen as soon as the protective shell of US power started to leave the government, started to leave Kabul, that things would not last for very long. I think that was, for many of us, that was very obvious. And for me, going there last year, January, February, just before, I remember there was just whispers of COVID at the time. It was pretty clear that the Afghan government was not calling the shots and was completely dependent on foreign military power.
When you, Joe, see the type of reception you got on a program like Hard Talk, you know, and it wasn't particularly adversarial, but there's a clear difference between the type of reception someone like Ben Wallace, when he takes an example out of the Matt Hancock handbook of Crocodile Tears and says he has a special appreciation for those left behind by the British Army because he's a soldier. You know, let's not forget that the Defence Minister, Ben Wallace, was Overseas Director of Kinetic. Kinetic made billions off of the war in Afghanistan, the occupation of Afghanistan, not just selling military hardware to the US government, to the British government, to the Dutch government, among others. Do we know if Ben Wallace had any shares in Kinetic or has any shares in Kinetic? Do we know if Ben Wallace personally benefited from the occupation of Afghanistan? What explains this pathological deference, really, that is paid by really across the board in a uniform way in English language media towards men of the Ministry of Defence?
It's bizarre, isn't it? How I think the military is a sacred cow, and I think some of it's a very English conceit, a British conceit, however you'd like to frame it, that we think of ourselves as a warrior nation, and we pride ourselves in our military. And again, as I was saying earlier, we see our military as a moral force because we see it through the prism of our one arguably moral war, the only one. Second World War colours everything, colours absolutely everything. And I suppose, I mean, they say there are two sacred cows, the royals and the military, which is why they love Harry so much, because he joins those worlds. But there is, I am, and many others like me, are the wrong kind of veterans. We're the wrong kind of military people because we are dissenters. We're what I've come to term critical veterans who've been through a process of thinking about what we do, trying to contextualise it. And there is no place in the discourse for really critical veterans. I mean, you saw some criticism today from people like Tom Tugendhat, Dan Jarvis, veterans who become MPs, but always within the framework which is permitted, always teed up with our brave boys and the House may know I served in Afghanistan, and lots of gushing platitudes about the military. But for people like me, the dissenters and the outsiders, there is no public platform. The BBC invited me on. I spoke on the BBC this morning for the first time in 6 years, 7 years, maybe longer. And there's no space for our voices because we cause such gigantic dissonance. I think the idea that you could be a veteran, soldier, sailor, airman, and not agree with the imperial project, which Britain is a party to, is just beyond the pale. It's just, I think it's probably a kind of heresy, and the idea that it's a heresy is so deep. It's not like something that BBC journalists, for example, consciously think about. It's so deep that they're probably not even conscious of these parameters themselves, I suspect, in some cases. And we are, as I say, we are beyond the pale. We're heretics in a country which is absolutely in love with a martial fantasia about what it is and what we are in our history and our present.
And where does Churchill come into that sort of deity, would you say?
I mean, he's a central figure. He's a central figure. The old bigot, an avid, rabid colonialist his whole life. I remember Tobias Elwood said, as it was kicking off, as a refugee crisis and the Kabul stuff was kicking off, the turmoil was visible. People were falling out of planes onto Kabuli rooftops. They were using Apaches to clear the runway. He said, what would Churchill say? And I thought, I'm going to look. And I knew Churchill had served on what was then called the Northwest Frontier as a 23-year-old soldier. And there was several racist diatribes about the Afghans, as fierce as tigers, but not as clean, or it's words to that effect. Classic Churchill stuff. And he's a central figure, loved by conservatives, loved by liberals who feel obliged to love him because they see him as this indisputable figure. He's a kind of totem, isn't he? He's kind of totem. Even in terms of World War II, like, I don't think Churchill fired a single shot in World War II against the fascists, or stoked a single ship, or fueled a single Spitfire. And yet he's synonymous. He's one man. It's not the sweat and the blood of thousands of people who struggled against fascism. And died against it. It's all kind of folded into this one figure who is himself a racist, a bigot, some of whose views would not look out of place in the National Socialist Party, which he was opposing at the time. He's an absolutely central totemic figure in this whole thing.
I mean, and also while he was in Afghanistan, Churchill had said that the Pashtuns need to recognise the superiority of the British race. And that he even, at one point, when talking about what what the missions were, he basically describes kind of genocidal violence. He says, we proceeded systematically village by village, and we destroyed the houses, filled up the wells, blew down the towers, cut down the great shady trees, burned the crops, and broke the reservoirs in punitive devastation. Mm-hmm. You know, this is who they look at as their, you know, their idol and their icon. I think also it's important that it is emphasized at this time where seemingly the British government, despite being part of the cause for an estimated 5.3 million refugees coming out of Afghanistan, have discovered the humanity of Afghans, when literally over the last 3 to 4 decades, you've seen around 35,000 people die trying to enter the EU because of policies set by governments who are directly involved in the occupation of Afghanistan. In the last few years, you've seen Afghan children die at sea trying to enter the EU. And in one case, the father of the child that died, a six-year-old boy, is potentially facing 10 years in prison for that child's death. You also have situations where people have killed themselves, like Habib Sharoush on the 25th of May 2019, committed suicide in a refugee camp in Strasbourg because of the situation he was facing, not being allowed to fully become a part of the society. How hypocritical is it of those who seem to depict bombing people and invading people as helping them and providing them with safe passage to asylum as a completely disgusting thing? Let's talk about some of that hypocrisy.
I see this stuff playing out. I see this stuff playing out. And I suppose there's all kinds of aspects to this, isn't there? I suppose the one which seems to me most insidious, which happened 20 years ago and is happening today, is the argument about women. That war and occupation is good for women. And that was particularly, a large part of the rhetoric for going to Afghanistan in the first place was that it would improve the conditions of women. And I even believed it at the time. It was one of the justifications, I suppose, I internalized to some extent. Now, when I look at the effects of the occupation, and it's not, I think Action on Armed Violence, great little NGO, Ian Overton works there, got some figures a couple of years ago. 40% of the people killed in airstrikes, our airstrikes, were women. And it's just to be, you know, critical and rational for a moment. Obviously, we know that in any society, women face lots of problems in inequities and inequalities. The idea that if you were to then add to that the occupying soldier, the drone strike, the militia, the corrupt official, that those things would be improved. It's just bizarre to me. And yet still all day in Parliament, particular kinds, particularly like people on the right of the Labour Party, I think, I really have internalized this idea, this liberal interventionist idea, that war somehow generally does now or has ever improved the condition of women. It's just bizarre to me. On top of that, I think the refugee, it's just so important, the refugee question. 20,000, but only 5,000 in the first year. And what do the other 15,000 do? Even like 20,000 is not enough for a start. But let's say we accept that figure. What do the other 15,000 people who need to leave do until whatever date in the future they're allowed in? What about all the Afghans who are in Europe who are displaced by British bombs and British bullets? Now, it's just bizarre to me that they still roll out these arguments. It's the inhumanity of it. And when you look at this stuff long enough, I'm sure you know this, you can almost become numb to it. You can almost become numb to it because it is so bleak. But it's to listen to them go through the motions again today, people, the Stella Creases of the world, to go through this stuff again, it's just difficult to listen to be honest. Having been there as a soldier and as a civilian, and having seen how unlivable we've made that place for so many people, it's just beyond belief to me.
Well, also, when you think about Britain and the United States as having, you know, their own homegrown, quote unquote, incel movement, you look at the fact that across the last 15 years or so, you've seen around 200,000 children in the United States marry legally, some as young as 10. Also, when you think about DynCorp, which was a military contractor owned by Veritas Capital, which is described by the New York Times as the second largest military contractor in Iraq and Afghanistan after Kellogg Brown and Root. This organization, DynCorp, had been found in the 90s to have 14 employees in Bosnia selling minors as sex slaves among each other. And the two people that reported it within the organization, DynCorp, were actually fired on the spot. And the people that it was alleged were doing this faced no form of punishment because of the immunity that they enjoyed under Bosnian law. When you look at the fact that this organization got massive contracts in Afghanistan and were found to be hiring the services of underage child prostitutes, and it was such a problem that the US ambassador in 2009 had several meetings about it and in fact had to write back to Washington about the DynCorp problem. You know, the hypocrisy of this situation is massive. And also the idea that these mythologies still endure and still outlive the very wars that they were created to push is something that we really have to be clear about and have to work hard on a daily basis to discredit these mythologies within British society. When you look at the fact that 0.18% of British society are refugees, you compare that to places like Turkey, places like Pakistan, places like Iran, places like Jordan, the neighboring countries of where these wars have happened, far more people have had to go there to find safe haven. But you compare the fact that if you are a refugee in this country and you do have recourse to public funds, which many do not, it's £37.50 a week. Now, we have to ask ourselves, Rupert Murdoch was found for 11 years to pay almost no corporation tax in this country, despite the fact that he was in control of a massive proportion of the media. And he still, to this day, keeps a lot of his earnings in a very complicated network of tax havens around the world. Who is the bigger enemy of the population in this country? Rupert Murdoch or 0.18% who are sitting next to you in the waiting room at the hospital or doctors where the services have been cut by figures like George Osborne, who now works at the Evening Standard? How can we fight back against this vertical solidarity and horizontal hatred which is cultivated on a daily basis, Joe?
It's a difficult one. I think it's difficult because we're going to have to rebuild now. There was almost a moment. There appeared, as you know, a moment recently with Corbynism when it seemed like something might be done, that we might be able to take control of the state almost and do something. And perhaps that could have come off, but it didn't. And now I think it's a time to refresh our ideas. The aims haven't changed. They're exactly what you're talking about. It's challenging the kind of vertical solidarity of press barons, of generals, of politicians, of bankers, and so on. But now it's time to kind of revise that. And I always remember something you said. I always remember you said to me when you came on my podcast some years ago, organize in person. I think we have to kind of get offline and we have to go find each other and we have to talk to each other and we have to organize from there. I think that's a key thing. But we need to move on from the trauma of that defeat, which happened recently, and we need to have some fresh ideas, and you know, go back to, you know, go to the movements, build stuff in our communities as well. I think that was something that was missing from that period of struggle, was building stuff in communities. Lots of stuff was happening at the top, and that bottom up stuff, which is where our power can flow from, was never really done. And I think we need to talk about those ideas. I don't have a plan any more than anyone else, but I think those are the concepts we need to come to terms with personally. Bottom up, build from the bottom up, build in person, build in communities.
Absolutely, man. And build long term, you know?
Yeah.
So the last question I have, and thank you so much for joining us. I feel we could go on for a lot longer. There is a lot of great information and experience that we could learn from you. So it would be great for us to get you back at some point too. It's important that everybody checks out your essential work in the Canary and support the Canary too. But your next book after Soldier's Box is Veteranhood, Rage and Hope in British Ex-Military Life. It's coming out in November. Can you tell us about that book, please, Joe?
I am trying to add something new, something radical and something humanist to analyze veterans' lives and veterans' culture in a radical and humanist way, to get past some of the, I suppose, the cliches, the assumptions around veterans. And I look at various things in the book. I look at resistance by veterans and military people, and we have a long tradition of it in this country, all the way back, far past living memory, of all veterans coming back from war, angry, organizing for a better world. It's a very proud tradition, but it's often obscured. So part of it's about that. I'm also looking at why particular cohorts of veterans go the other way, why they become fascists, why they become far-right nationalists and so on, and where that comes from, what the culture of the military does to them and why it sends them spinning off in different directions. So I'm trying to kind of pay homage to the radical tradition. I'm trying to explain why we see veterans on far-right protests, why we see veterans defending statues, and why we see veterans doing things which are associated with far-right politics. On top of that, I'm really trying to come up with a better way to be us, I suppose, a better way to come to terms with our experiences, our training, and what we are, which is positive and humanist and radical, and to take our part in the struggles of the day, really.
Fantastic. Joe, thank you so much for joining us from the fantastic legacy of anti-war heroes in World War One that refused to kill, from the soldiers that mutinied. You know, we forget that often it was the mutinies that ended World War One in the end, to the heroes of Greenham Common and other struggles. You and I aspire to also be at your side as one of those who have continued that proud legacy of anti-war tradition within this country. Thank you for joining us, Joe. Hope to see you again.
Pleasure.